You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Turkey continues to pick a diplomatic row with the United States. But even if Washington notices, where is Ankara going with this? My guests Michael Binion and Mary Dajewski will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including a new government in the Netherlands after such a long period without one that you could start to wonder whether the Netherlands really needs a government, whether Catalonia's government has thought through the way forward if they declare independence and everyone ignores them, and
he is one of the most powerful men in Hollywood. Now Oscar-winning producer Harvey Weinstein is facing serious allegations of sexual harassment. Among his accusers, actress Ashley Judd.
Is the downfall of Harvey Weinstein the beginning of the end for men like Harvey Weinstein? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist with The Guardian and The Independent, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Welcome both. Now, it might have been imagined that Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Turkey and Donald Trump's United States would be natural soulmates, were it not for the fact that among the many things that the two presidents have in common are a massive persecution complex and a fondness for conflict and drama. Turkey has today issued a warrant for the arrest of the second US consulate employee in a week, despite the arrest of the first, resulting in a mutual suspension of visa services between Ankara and Washington, and something of a run on Turkish stocks. Mary, first of all, broadly speaking, because this is one of those stories, when you start pulling one particular string, a whole, I don't even know where that metaphor is going, but as far as we can tell, what is actually going on here?
It's very, very hard to divine. Basically, I think Turkey is continually very angry with the Americans because the Americans have refused to deliver up or even challenge the asylum for the author of what is seen in Turkey as the Julian conspiracy. And so they've been in Ankara. They have been picking off people for a very long, ever since, and I think there are hundreds of people under arrest or in detention, or who've been sacked from quite prominent jobs, and so that's where, if you like, these two arrests of people associated with the American embassy come in, because, and this is one of the hobby horses that of mine, I think it's incredibly dangerous for countries to appoint nationals of the country where they're represented to work for their embassies. I think it puts people in danger. The moment there's any suggestion of tension, we've seen this with Russia, we've seen it with Iran, now we're seeing it with Turkey. You've got native people, Turkish citizens in this case, who are employed by the American embassy, and they have no diplomatic protection. And of course, the foreign embassies like it because they're much cheaper to employ than professional embassy staff from the US who would want expat packages for their terms, living conditions and salaries. But I think the danger of this, I mean, the British do it, lots of people do it, but I think it puts people's lives and livelihoods in danger.
Michael, it does seem to be the case that, as Mary says, this is tied in with Erdogan's insistence that he is the victim of this vast web being spun by this rather quiet and unprepossessing cleric who is exiled in the United States. Do we have any real sense of where the line between reality and fantasy is, where the Gulenist conspiracy is concerned? I mean, we all project, I think, our own view of the world on things, and as myself a massive fan of cock-up over conspiracy every time, I quite like the idea that this poor old duffer is turning on the news every day completely bewildered as to why he's being held accountable for running this massive operation against the Turkish state.
Yes, I wouldn't put him as quite so innocently naive sitting there in his happy exile in America. I think his followers have been very very involved in this coup, the failed coup, but whether he actually directed it or to what extent he was personally responsible for it is completely unknown. It's certainly true that when he was a man of influence, and together with the present president, they were once great mates, they did indeed try to infiltrate the entire Turkish civil service with their own supporters who had their own agenda, which was the Islamization of the Turkish state. The two fell out, and now Erdogan sees the hand of Gulen behind every single challenge to his own authority. And indeed, I think there is evidence that the Gulenists were to some extent involved in this coup, probably quite heavily involved. But there is no direct evidence, as far as the American prosecutors are concerned, to tie him to foreign conspiracies and the breaking of US law. So they have not put him up for extradition, or rather they have not said we will send him back, unless the Turks present a bona fide case as to why they should send him back. And the Turks are furious about that, and that's what the whole spat is all about.
Mary, over and above the guilt or otherwise of Fethullah Gulen in orchestrating last summer's coup d'etat, is there potentially any kind of advantage to as far as Erdogan's concerned, either at home or abroad, in being seen to pick a massive fight with the United States?
Well, that is a very interesting question, because whether by accident or by design, Erdogan seems to be ploughing a furrow now, very much striving for something like equidistance between the United States and, among others, Russia. We've seen Turkey anger the United States by signing up for anti-missile technology from the Russians. We've seen Turkey not being terribly cooperative with the Americans over their particular designs for Syria. And there are times when it's actually quite hard to believe that Turkey is a NATO ally. And I'm sure that's how it looks from Washington.
Looking at it from Washington, Michael, is there any particularly good reason why the US should engage with this at all? Is the US, for whatever reason at this point, obliged to take Turkey's complaints about anything seriously?
Well, inasmuch as Turkey is a NATO ally, as Mary says, a NATO member, a very key NATO member in a very strategic area, it is important to try to keep them at least nominally on board, because if you want NATO capabilities in any way on the edge of the kind of permanent seething turmoil in the Middle East, Turkey is there, and the Americans do have important bases in Turkey. Now, Mr. Erdogan clearly thinks that the Russians are a better bet at the moment, and there have been some fairly wonderful words spoken by President Putin, who has been down visiting Ankara not very long ago. And as Mary said, they have signed an important arms deal, which must make the Americans think, well, whose side are they on? You know, are they in our tent or are they in the other tent? And I think the Americans are being irritated. And of course, as you said right at the beginning, Donald Trump quite likes to be irritated, in that he can be irritating back again.
Well, plenty more to look forward to there, I suspect. But let's take a look now at a slightly quieter polity, the Netherlands, which may this week find itself with a government after 208 days of not having had one. This has been the time taken to negotiate a coalition from the parties elected back in March. Mark Rutte, the Prime Minister, will unveil a rickety centre-right coalition comprising his own VVD, the more radically progressive D66, and two Christian parties of varying severity. And for an illustration of the conflicts which may erupt inside this broad tent, consider that D66 wants to extend euthanasia laws, whereas the Christian Union wants them abolished entirely. Michael, I've done the maths, as I'm sure Mark Rutte has, and as I'm sure Mark Rutte has, I've triple-checked them. It gives him a one-seat majority.
Not very much.
It's not very much. Is this going to work?
It might. I mean, I think the reason it might stagger on is that nobody else has much interest in undermining it and bringing it down. There may be votes on a case-by-case basis. The key thing is that all these parties are determined to keep out the far right, which was the worry all
along.
This
is Geert Wilders' Party for Freedom.
Exactly, the Wilders Party, and that was the one that looked as though it was going to sweep the board at the time of the election 7 months ago. It didn't. Their support appears to have peaked, but of course none of the other parties are taking that for granted. So rather than let him in, and rather than have the government collapse and force new elections, I think they're determined to get this thing on the road, at least for the moment. There will come probably issues, as the one you mentioned, namely euthanasia and perhaps other social issues, where there will be tremendous strains in the coalition and they may be allowed to vote according to their conscience. But I think Rutte feels, feels he's got a stable enough government now to carry on with the main business of government.
Mary, it does seem pretty clear that it is, as Michael said, that this is an effort to keep Geert Wilders out of government. He does, however, whatever you will say about him, and I'd probably agree with it, lead the second largest party in the Dutch House. Is it the right thing to do to keep him out of government at absolutely all costs? The difficulty being with somebody like Wilders is obviously this adds further fuel to his put-upon, persecuted outsider status.
Yes, absolutely. And this is always the dilemma, that when you have a relatively popular party such as Geert Wilders, that everybody wants, sees as unacceptable in government, then you can cobble together this sort of coalition and it looks like everybody against, in this case, Geert Wilders, and it can have the effect of strengthening their support, because, as you said, they play the victim and they say, you know, everybody wants to keep us out of power, despite the democratic system and the amount of popular support. Now, I think, fortunately, in this particular case, because Wilders didn't do nearly as well as had been forecast in the elections, that seems so very, very long ago now, his claim to victimhood is, if you like, a lot less than it would have done if he'd done so much better. But it also risks storing up trouble for the future, because what you see, and you see it also with the sort of centrist coalitions as Germany has had for so long, that then the people on either side never really feel that they have any sort of investment or stake in power, because they're always going to be kept on the sidelines.
Is there an argument here somewhere, Michael, that it's actually better all round if political parties after elections spend months and months and months and months arguing and negotiating rather than attempting to govern? Because one is put in mind, of course, of the experience of Belgium at the turn of the decade, which went 541 days without a government and still seemed to work pretty fine at the end of it. The Netherlands' GDP is up 3.3% this year.
Well, I think the Dutch are hardworking and will work hard whoever governs them. It's very hard, difficult to stop the Dutch working hard, and therefore they are going to be reasonably successful, whatever the economic circumstances. Belgium's a slightly different case, because Belgium really doesn't have a strong central government ever. It is
true
comprised
enough
of two sections, Flanders and Wallonia, which are more or less independent states, which are just linked in a very loose federal arrangement. I think a more interesting example that has immediate relevance to the Netherlands is Austria at the moment, where they have the Freedom Party, which is a very strong and pretty far-right party, where there's been the endless question as to should they be brought into a coalition. And instead of doing that, the ruling Conservatives, in coalition with the Social Democrats, they've decided simply to steal all the ideas of the far-right party to try to undermine them that way and put forward the same pretty anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant agenda that the far-right party was putting forward.
I mean, to return to that argument, Mary, is there an argument for pushing the unsavoury far-right party in government and then giving them all the cabinet jobs that nobody ever wants because they're terrible and just make you look bad?
Well, you certainly get the impression that where far-right parties in particular have been given a small share in power, that it has, as it were, never been repeated because it's never been judged a success. And you saw that on a small scale, if you like, in Britain. When the British National Party was at its height, and it was winning all sorts of seats in local elections, to the point where it was taking part in on local councils in several parts of the country, very, very few of them were re-elected. And in a way, it removed them from power for more than a decade afterwards. So you can argue that giving them a share in power discredits them to the point that it shows the public how incapable they are of exercising that power, or how unacceptable the policies that they're putting forward are.
I would say exactly the same thing has happened in the Middle East with the Islamists. Jordan, very smartly, has several times included Islamists in its government and said, right, now what is your solution to this? And they have absolutely no solution except Islam is the answer. And the voters, in the end, turned completely against them. They said, well, if that's all they're putting forward, we don't want them in power.
It is always a great way, I think, of neutralising revolutionaries. Just tell them that, you know, tell them it's now your problem that the bins get collected once a week and water comes out of the taps. They quite often tend to do that very badly. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Mary Dejewski and Michael Binion. Coming up next, at what point did the allegations against Harvey Weinstein become one too many? And just how isolated could Catalonia have made itself? Do stay tuned.
For Monocle's retail-themed October issue, our editors turn their gaze to the plucky shopkeepers and business folk, looking beyond the dire headlines and still turning a profit by keeping our high streets lively. We meet the people behind a wise weekend market venture in Frome in the UK, the retailers rebuilding Italy's Portocervo and touting their wares in Taichung. Not to mention a retail survey brimming with bright ideas in bricks and mortar. We also see how cities can kickstart their own revival, from Detroit to Yangon. Peek into the studio of artist Gary Hume and ogle the enviable new digs of an architecture practice who took over a dilapidated department store in South London. All before our selection of the 25 smartest sartorial finds from the world of fashion. All this and much more besides can be found in Monocle's October issue, which is out now and available from all good newsstands.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Michael Binion. Now, the Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein now has more time to work on his inevitable emetic memoir chronicling his journey to redemption following his dismissal by the board of the production company, which, for the moment, bears his name. This follows the publication of a story in the New York Times about persistent, recurrent, and prolific allegations of sexual harassment against Weinstein. Though Weinstein has apologised for his conduct, he has also threatened to sue the Times. Mary, first of all, since the story ran, we have seen quite a few actors speaking up in condemnation of Weinstein, and quite rightly, if half the allegations against him are true. Meryl Streep, Seth Rogen, Mark Ruffalo, among others. Do we imagine that they're entirely surprised, however?
Well, it doesn't seem that any of them have been surprised, and my impression is that actually there's quite a lot of criticism washing around of saying, not only what took you so long in the course of the last sort of 20 years, but what took you so long since the New York Times revelations, because the number of people who actually came out with revelations of their own or with condemnation was really not very many and not very fast. And Meryl Streep was one of the ones who was criticised for not responding quite as quickly as it was thought appropriate.
Michael, are we buying entirely Weinstein's statement? He said, I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behaviour in workplaces were different. That was the culture then. I have since learned it's not an excuse in the office or out of it. Now, I didn't come of age in the 60s and 70s, but I'm reasonably sure that during that period that there were probably quite a lot of men who realised even then that this was not a way to behave.
People realised it was not a way to behave, but he is right in that a great many people did behave like that. And it really was very much the culture of Hollywood. They had the phrase, the casting couch, and it was more or less taken for granted. And it was neither condoned, nor accepted, nor indeed spoken about very much. And I think one of the reasons for reticence is that to some extent, the victims were to some extent complicit in their own victimhood. They didn't dare speak out because they thought they wouldn't get jobs. They didn't also dare speak out because it would make them look somewhat pusillanimous and sort of afraid to stand up for their own rights. And I think, you know, if you say, I've been a victim, the question is, well, why didn't you do something about it at the time? So there is a certain degree of sort of embarrassment about talking about this, and I think that may account for the reticence. And I think, of course, predators, if these are to be believed, these stories, predators use that as an excuse to go ahead.
Is that the common dynamic, do you think, Mary? Because obviously Harvey Weinstein is far from the first powerful person of whom it has been revealed in recent years has behaved fairly abominably under the cover of that power. Is that how it works? Are they able to get away with it just because people are or have been embarrassed? And I guess the better question is, can we at least hope that people are becoming less embarrassed about speaking
Well, I
up?
Think that's in fact the big point, because I agree with absolutely everything that Michael said. Everybody knew about it. Everybody almost took it for granted. And there really wasn't an enormous amount of opprobrium attached to it. More recently, maybe even as recently as about the last 5 years, it's become that sort of behaviour has become unacceptable. And it's become unacceptable largely because the women who say that it's happened to them and name names are prepared to go public in a way that didn't happen before. And they can do that because, in a way, the social climate is such that to come out with those sort of revelations, to tell the truth about it, is now more socially acceptable than to cover things up.
Just to follow that up, though, Mary, you're right, obviously, but the President of the United States is who the President of the United States is. It is almost exactly a year since the release of the Access Hollywood tape.
Yes, that's a wonderful coincidence, isn't it?
Hilarious coincidence. Donald Trump, by which I mean not hilarious at all, Donald Trump Sr. has said that he wasn't surprised at all to hear of these revelations of Harvey Weinstein's behaviour. Even more interestingly, Donald Trump Jr., has called attention to Weinstein's links with Hillary Clinton. Not the first time where we see somebody finding a way to blame women for the appalling behaviour of men. It seems a strange fight for Donald Trump Jr. to pick, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Unless, of course, he sees a distinction between the way his father was talking and the way the allegations suggest that Harvey Weinstein was behaving. Now, we don't know whether that distinction exists or not, but that may be what Donald Trump Jr. was trying to get at. But I think that there's something else about this as well, which is that even though now the social climate has changed so much, nonetheless, a year ago, when those revelations came out about Trump and he was campaigning for president, they didn't harm him nearly as much as a lot of us thought they would.
Well, there was a widespread assumption that that was it. It was all over.
There was that assumption, but there was also, I overheard people talking about this, American women talking about this and saying, well, no, they really weren't that bothered about it because that was the way my father or my grandfather used to talk. And they sort of put it in a box of bygone age. And so long as that was something not happening today, then it wasn't something that they were too exercised about.
Michael, just a final thought on this. Are we keen on the redemption narrative which is already being plotted for Weinstein? His lawyer, although she has now resigned, said last week he's reading books and going to therapy. He's an old dinosaur learning new ways. He's a man in his mid-60s. And people said the same thing about Donald Trump. He is who he's going to be at this point, isn't he?
Of course he is. I mean, this whole therapy thing and the public confession, and it's all part of this sort of mawkish let your feelings all hang out and you will be redeemed. It's some sort of born-again good person. It doesn't make a bean of difference.
That's a very American thing. Much less of that in the UK.
Oh, it wouldn't work here at all. But I think Americans do rather fall for this idea. I'm going to turn myself over. I'm going to be a new man. I will be redeemed. I'll be saved. I'll be completely different. And we'll just see whether he is. But I don't think it means he gets his job back.
Okay, well, we shall see how that plays out. But finally tonight, to Catalonia, which is finding congratulations on its independence referendum difficult to come by. France's government has said that it will not recognise any declaration of independence by Catalonia and that any such move would result in Catalonia's expulsion from the EU. It's certainly difficult to imagine Spain enthusiastically endorsing any reapplication from Barcelona. Mary, assuming Catalonia does declare independence, as it is threatening to, is anybody going to recognise it? I mean, might Russia, just for a bit of a lark?
I don't think even Russia would. I may be very wrong about that, but I very much doubt it. I think there is a huge problem with this, which the European Commission was blamed for not supporting the Catalan cause after the referendum and after the what was very obviously just outrageous police brutality and the tactics used to try and stop or discredit the referendum. European Commission was very heavily criticised for that, and people said, "Well, why has Brussels been so relatively quick to condemn countries like Poland and Hungary for sort of moving towards, as it's seen, authoritarian ways of doing things, backsliding on that front, but there was nothing about Catalonia. And of course, the problem here is that this is separatism, and the Scottish parallel comes to mind, but I think you can see in a way that one of David Cameron's maybe wiser moves was to permit the referendum so that it was legal, and then when it was held legally and the vote went against independent, both the holding of the referendum and the decision were accepted. What you have in Catalonia is you have what's seen as an illegal referendum, and the European Union is not going to endorse it, and that means that other people aren't going to endorse it because they see similar things possibly happening in not every country, but huge numbers of countries where there are one or more separatist movements.
Michael, is there a Brexit parallel here, if you will? People submitting to some sort of sentimental, atavistic delirium and then realising that the practicalities of that are going to be rather more complex. We've already seen quite a substantial number of quite large employers in Catalonia saying, well, we're off, we're leaving.
Indeed. Well, I mean, I think the Scottish parallel is the closest one, and that is that the Scots also were faced with the prospect of a large number of businesses moving from Scotland to England, had the referendum looked as though it was going to be successful, and in fact they did start moving, but I think that is the reason that there wasn't a second referendum, because people realised it would be economically disastrous. The tide has turned there, and I think the tide is turning already in Catalonia. We've seen this large march of those who want to remain united, the silent majority. One wonders, well, why didn't they make a bit more noise beforehand?
It's the trouble with your silent majorities.
They never speak. But I do think, actually, they're already looking for ways to row back. I think the announcement tomorrow will not be a straight declaration of independence. I think it will be something slightly less, talking about autonomy. I think it will be talking about a future timetable. It won't be today we're free from Spain. It won't be that, because they know quite well that would be economic disaster tomorrow.
I think that's entirely true, but the the problem is that expectations have been raised so high among Catalans, and Madrid has been so reluctant until now to give any sort of space to allow that rowing back, and that's why everything is so dangerous.
Mm. I mean, is there a way forward, Michael, if you do declare independence and the entire rest of the world just goes, bleh?
Well, I mean, I suppose there isn't much, no. I mean, various people have declared independence. I mean, little bits of Britain have been declared independent from time to time.
A farm in Western Australia declared independence in the 70s.
Indeed, and various towns have declared themselves non-nuclear zones, so that when the Russians dropped nuclear weapons all over Britain, they would have to miss out this particular town or village. People take no notice at all. I mean, a big region like that was a very important economic region. This is a big political problem, and I quite agree with Mary. It's time Madrid treated it as a political issue and negotiated. But in terms of the way forward, well, I think autonomy is the best.
We'll have more on that as the week unfolds. That brings us to the end of today's show. Mary Dujewski and Michael Binion, thanks for joining us. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. And our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next, 1900 It's Culture with Robert Bound, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.